dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
this week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week on the program, I began reading you from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. In asking what unifies all the seemingly disparate problems and crises we have, Eisenstein zeroes in on our core myth in Western civilization that the aim of human progress is to dominate nature, and how this is justified in both religious texts and in the secular beliefs of science and technology. That we would have the outcomes we have is not surprising when one examines the value systems that guide the choices our society makes. But first, two other segments that I think illustrate exactly what Eisenstein is talking about, that both deal with the use of land, the production of food, and the way dominant institutions have defined progress, and not to mention the various agendas also at play. We'll begin with a talk that was given as part of a conference put on by the National Lawyers Guild in Seattle on the Law of the Commons held last March. I'd like to preface some of the remarks made by Professor Stephen Tan, the first speaker. In the talk, he describes both the role of the state and business interests in creating agribusiness and a legacy of destruction of the land. He goes into detail on the westward expansion of the United States. He does not acknowledge the fact that people were living in those areas already, people who had not destroyed the land. Tan also contrasts the issue of private and state ownership of land and its outcomes, and it seems to me that both models have resulted in destruction and preservation. For those of us who quote-unquote own land and consider it a sacred trust to nurture, we often see the policies of government to be as antagonistic as rapacious corporations. In fact, there is at times little difference. As many of the programs critical of the regulatory system as a sham have clearly demonstrated. With that caveat, it is nonetheless an interesting presentation. We'll follow that with an interview dealing with food and biopiracy in Africa, another issue of the commons, and then close out with the ascent of humanity.
We had a slight change in our program. Beth Burroughs, who was to be our next speaker, got called away on a personal emergency and was not able to make it. But we have a very, very deep faculty, and that we were able to call on Stephen Tan from the Cascadia Law Group here in Seattle, who is going to be our next speaker. I'm very pleased with Stephen Tan, who is an environmental litigator and is also the chair of the PCC, the Puget Consumer Co-op, which I understand to be the largest co-op of its type in the United States, I believe, and also dealing with issues of farmland preservation. I'm a member, and we help preserve those farms. Mr. Tan is going to be talking about the question of the rights and wrongs of the American farm.
Thank you, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be here today and have the opportunity to speak to this group. The theme for the day is a very interesting one, and that is the privatization of resources that by all rights probably should belong to the commons. And as has been said, I think our purpose here today, actually a couple. One is to recognize the many ways in which the loss of common resources manifests itself, And then secondly, to understand how the legal and social and political systems have facilitated that trend. My topic today starts with what I understand to be the original concept of the commons, and that is the privatization of the resource of real property, land, specifically farmland, land devoted to agriculture. My goal this morning is to cover three topics. First, the reasons that this resource has tended to end up in the hands of private interests, particularly corporate interests. Second, the impacts that flow from having so much of this resource in private hands, and why ownership by corporate interests is particularly impactful. And then third, how the laws and policies implemented on private property, specifically agricultural policies, affect public land and public resources, for good and for bad. And it is this characteristic, how publicly owned land can be, how privately owned land can impact publicly held land and resources, that I think makes this particular resource unique. To provide some context for my discussion this morning, let me start by providing an overview of the origins of farming. And I promise I'll try not to make this too dull. It's actually quite interesting, at least I believe so. Centuries ago, the land on this planet available for farming was actually quite limited. You had to have land within a certain band of the Earth, approximately 20 degrees latitude to 55 degrees latitude in both the northern and southern hemispheres. You had to have soils of a certain texture, of a certain acidity, of a certain chemical composition, what we commonly refer to as fertility. You had to have a source of water, whether that's rainfall or irrigation. And if you were doing more than feeding yourself and feeding your family, what we refer to as subsistence farming, you had to be close enough to a population center and have a means to transport your crop to a population center if you're seeking to have a go at making a living off the land. Now, the vast majority of land around the world don't meet these criteria. But on continents where civilization and development have been occurring for centuries, very little of that land was therefore claimed by private owners. There was little reason for private citizens or private entities to lay claim to this land because it was not agriculturally viable. And so this land essentially remained in public hands. It's essentially defaulted to the ownership and the custody and the control of the nation or the state. On the North American continent, where we live, something very different happened. Most of this continent wasn't settled until well into the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. And so the United States as a nation was always playing catch-up with the rest of the developed world. So from independence, there was a push to transfer land out of public hands into private hands as quickly as possible. And that transfer, that wholesale transfer of real property, was the means by which the United States sought to accelerate its development and catch up with the rest of the world. Of course, there were laws passed to facilitate this transfer, the most commonly known ones of which are the Homestead Acts. The first Homestead Act in 1860 sold land for the premium price of 25 cents an acre. And the only reason that this land wasn't given away for free was that the southern states were concerned that people claiming this land, laying claim to these homesteads in the West, would settle it, that this land would become eligible for statehood, and that those states would become free states, therefore upsetting the balance between slaveholding states and free states. Therefore, the 25-cent premium on each acre of land. 2 years later, of course, by 1862, this country was embroiled in the Civil War. federal government, at least the northern federal government, no longer cared what the southern states wanted or believed, and so they actually did start giving away land. And people were eligible at this time under this act to lay claim to 160 acres of land, what is known as a quarter section, essentially for free. The only requirement being that the claimant developed the land for what was called consumption and farming, and that is that this land be tilled and cultivated for agriculture. There were a variety of loan acts as well that provided low interest, long-term loans in the event that people actually needed to pony up money to buy this land. So the settlement, of course, the United States proceeded westward, first proceeded through an ecosystem known as the Tall Grass Prairie. This is the area in the American Midwest for a couple of hundred miles on each side of the Mississippi River. It's an area characterized by tall grasses, adequate rainfall, very fertile soils. And then as time passed, this migration continued westward of the 98th meridian. And the significance of that I'll cover in a minute, but if you can imagine a line that essentially bisects the states of North Dakota, South Dakota, Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Texas, that's approximately the 98th meridian. The significance of that line is that east of that line, typically there is, on average, in excess of 20 inches of rain per year. West of that line, there's less than 20 inches of rain per year. 20 inches of rain per year is considered the minimum threshold to sustain agriculture. Did the United States distinguish between land suitable for agriculture and land suitable or not suitable for agriculture? It didn't. Now, this short grass prairie ecosystem west of the 98th meridian is characterized by short grasses, highly adapted to drought, highly adapted to fire. A fire would sweep across these plains on a periodic basis, burn everything above ground, but the root systems of this ecosystem remained intact. And it was this root system that held this soil, this topsoil, in place. Now, the government did recognize that this land west of the 98th meridian was somewhat marginal and possibly unsuitable for farming. So what it did was increase the amount of land that each claimant could claim. So whereas the original eligibility was a quarter section, 160 acres, the Enlarged Homestead Act of 1909 gave people the right to claim a half a section, 320 acres. The thinking here being that farmers could use twice as much land to grow a full crop because the land was half as productive. Of course, it doesn't work that way. With marginal land, you don't get half a crop every year. Some years you get a full crop, and some years, sometimes for many years, you get no crop. But still, there was a bona fide belief during this time period in the late 1800s into the early 1900s, that as people moved west, this land would automatically become hospitable and more suitable for farming. And here's how it worked. The belief actually originated for several reasons. First, there was a religious, almost philosophical belief that was referred to as manifest destiny, that Christian Anglo-Saxons were intended by God to hold dominion over North America. And this was also tied to this very American ethic of self-sufficiency. In fact, the slogan for these homestead acts from the 1860s was a quarter section and independence. That was the way in which these programs were marketed to potential homesteaders. There was also a very interesting scientific theory about how this land would become suitable for farming. And that is that the tilling of the soil the turning of the Earth would over time trigger atmospheric changes that would then bring rain to the prairie. There was actually a belief that steam from the locomotives carrying people west would rise through the sky, crystallize, and form rain clouds. So the saying at the time, which was believed by most people, was that rain follows the plow. And it didn't seem like it was pure fiction, because for several decades during this time period, this theory seemed to hold true. There was more than 20 inches of rain west of the 98th meridian. And so railroads at the time, who of course had an interest in the development of the West and the settlement of the West, actually published maps showing what they called the rain line, the line east of which received more than 20 inches of rain, the line west of which received less. They showed this rain line marching westward at approximately 18 to 20 miles per year. What wasn't understood, of course, is that this was a natural weather pattern. Weather is cyclical. And that just as you can be sure that in certain years, maybe for decades, you'll have higher than average rainfall, following that will be a period, sometimes a long period, in which there would be far less rainfall than normal. So it was always understood, despite this theory, this scientific theory, and despite manifest destiny, that this land west of the 98th meridian was marginal land. And so the attitude of many farmers who became homesteaders was similar to that of miners going into the hills and trying to strike it rich, trying to find a vein of gold or silver. Farmers during this time spoke of trying to hit a crop, meaning that they would farm for a year or two. If things worked out, that was great, and if they didn't, they would move on. Now, as you can imagine, this kind of farming practice did incredible damage to this ecosystem. Because this land was free, or essentially free, there were no incentives to preserve the health of this land. And there was also a lack of recognition that land and soil were two different commodities. Land was soil, soil was land, there was no distinction drawn between the two. And so the Federal Bureau of Soils, which no longer exists, but at the time was in charge of soils and land in the United States, called soil this nation's one indestructible, immutable asset, the one resource that cannot be exhausted. Well, as it turned out, of course, this resource could very easily be exhausted, and very quickly be exhausted, and it was. And when we talk about the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, that's, of course, what we're referring to. 1930 saw the beginning of an 8-year drought, where the sod and the topsoil that had been tilled became calcified, and during this period of far below average rainfall, was picked up by the wind and literally blown away. The descriptions at the times of the times were of black blizzards appearing on the horizon, what looked like storm clouds coming, except much darker. And these were actually windstorms picking up this soil, carrying it eastward. A new disease arose during this time. It was called dust pneumonia. People died of this disease, inhaling soil that had been picked up from this region that was so inappropriately farmed. During these storms, some of which would last for days, men, of course, would be housebound, but would have to check on their animals out in the barn. They'd have to tie a rope around a post on the front porch, make their way to the barn, and then use the rope to find their way back to the house. The impacts of these storms were felt far away from this particular region. One single storm in 1934 dumped an estimated 12 million tons of soil on the city of Chicago. The dust carried all the way to cities on the East Coast. This same storm in 1934 darkened the skies over Manhattan so that drivers had to turn on their headlights in order to see. This dust carried hundreds of miles out into the Atlantic Ocean. There were reports of captains of ships ordering their crews out on the decks to sweep the dust off of these vessels, 200 miles off the eastern seaboard. In the single worst year of the Dust Bowl, which was 1935, the southern Great Plains lost, on average, 480 tons of soil per acre. That is, in 1 year. This was an ecological catastrophe. And because it was a catastrophe of unprecedented scale, in some areas of the Great Plains, farming ended forever. In other areas, though, farming was saved. And it was saved by the Industrial Revolution. It was saved by chemical fertilizers that replaced, or pretended to replace, the fertility of the land. It was saved by new machinery that expanded the reach of farmers and allowed them to have dominion over now thousands of acres of land instead of hundreds. It was saved by irrigation projects and cheap water. And the result was that larger and larger parcels of the American West could be farmed, first by family farmers, and then by large corporate interests who swept in every time the economic climate allowed it. So every time there was a downturn and there was a wholesale sell-off of this land, you better believe that corporate interests were ready, willing, and able to step in and buy this land on the cheap. And so through this process arose a uniquely American invention, agribusiness. And it was made possible by a confluence, a coincidence of several factors. First, as I mentioned, the relatively late settlement of this continent, and the government's active push to transfer land out of public ownership into private hands. Second, the industrial age, the rise of the railroad, the rise of steel, the steel industry, and the availability of these machines. And then finally, the rise of capitalism and big business, particularly banking. All of which, of course, was facilitated by a legal and political system that favored fast, unplanned development through the privatization of land and the resources connected with that resource. So today, we have cropland and farmsteads occupying 450 million acres in the continental United States. That is one quarter of the total landmass of the lower 48. Essentially, all of that is privately held. To provide some context for that number, the total acreage of all land publicly held for preservation and recreation, I'm talking about state parks, national parks, wilderness, wildlife refuges, primitive areas, is a little over 100 million acres. So four times that is the amount of land held for agricultural purposes, whether it's suited for that purpose or not. We're all familiar with the image of the American family farm, and in fact, many farms to this day are still operated by families on land owned by big business. Back when farmers owned the land that they operated, there was at least some incentive to maintain the health, preserve the long-term health and viability of that land. That's far less true when these operators are merely paying for the right to operate this land, for the right to farm, especially when their only incentive is to maximize production. And in fact, farm productivity has become quite a matter of pride for Americans. We boast about being the breadbasket for the world. And in fact, with technological advances over the last 100 years, the number of calories that we can squeeze out of an acre of land is many, many times that what could have been achieved by a farmer back 100 years ago. During World War II alone, this four-year period between 1941 and 1945, per acre productivity on the American farm improved 50%. And this trend towards improving efficiency and productivity was reinforced most recently in the 1970s under the Nixon administration. The Secretary of Agriculture, Earl Butz, made it his goal to permanently industrialize American agriculture. He wanted to transform it to follow an industrial model, to encourage it to operate the same way that big business operates. His slogan, in fact, was, "Get big or get out." It was his intent to drive small farmers off of the land in the interest of efficiency and a far more productive agricultural system. So what have this history and these policies brought us? Well, I'll submit to you that it's brought us wholesale transfer of land out of public ownership into private ownership. That's clear. It's brought us the inappropriate use of this resource of real property. It's brought us the exhaustion of resources associated with that property, the permanent loss of topsoil, the most valuable asset on these lands in the prairie states. It's brought us nearly the destruction of the entire short grass prairie ecosystem. It's brought us a system that requires the devotion of massive amounts of other natural resources, specifically petroleum, in the form of fertilizers, to sustain itself. It's brought us a system that to this day depends on huge subsidies to sustain itself. We have subsidies to grow food. We have subsidies not to grow food. We have subsidies to convert food to fuel. So you have the ultimate irony here of petroleum fertilizers used to grow corn, used to make ethanol, intended to replace petroleum fertilizers as fuel. So to sum up the history of agriculture in the United States, back no more than 150 years ago, American agricultural policy got on a train heading in the wrong direction. And unfortunately, we're still on that train. We're still heading in that direction. So far, what I've discussed are of course, large-scale issues, national trends and the laws and the policies that drove those trends. I want to focus now on a much smaller scale, and that is what's happened and what is continuing to happen on individual farmsteads. And we'll see how what's happening there also has negative impacts on publicly owned land and publicly owned resources. Now, it used to be that farmers left certain areas of their property alone. And sometimes these areas were left in their natural state because the farmers got some kind of benefit from doing so. Groves of trees served as windbreaks. Ponds were used for water or for recreation. Meadows were used to pasture livestock. Other areas were left undisturbed simply because the terrain was too difficult to plow or the soil was too poor to sustain a crop. Over time, though, industrialization, fertilizers and herbicides could correct poor quality soils. Earth-moving machines could correct problematic terrain. Government incentives to improve efficiency drove farmers to till this land that previously had been untouched, especially policies that provided for subsidies largely based on the number of acres planted. So more and more land within the property boundaries of individual farms was put to what's called beneficial use, the only beneficial use that was recognized at the time, which is cultivation. And so farmers had both the means and the incentive to convert these farm margins, these border areas between their fields and on the farm borders, to cropland. And in the last 30, 35 years, farming fence row to fence row has become the normal practice. That's actually a phrase that was introduced in the early 70s by Secretary of Agriculture Butz, the one whose goal it was to industrialize American agriculture. And so hundreds of thousands of acres of farm borders and field margins disappeared from the landscape. We're talking about woods, grasslands, ponds, wetlands, riparian areas, these streamside habitats along streams and rivers. And this land ended up, as it turns out, was very, very important if left in that natural state. They provide what are known as environmental services. Now, these are services including the stabilization of soils, the prevention of erosion, the absorption and detoxification of agricultural chemicals. They provide wildlife habitat. They provide migratory corridors, particularly windbreaks and streamside habitats, habitats in which animals that don't like to travel out in the open can actually move about. Farm ponds provide stopover points for migratory birds. And in case there's any suspicion that maybe the loss of this land is not significant, it's well understood and well accepted now that agricultural expansion and the loss of this marginal, these farm margins, is the primary cause of habitat loss and habitat fragmentation in the lower 48 states. The loss of this land is implicated in the decline of approximately 40% of species listed on the endangered species list. So from the perspective of these environmental services, this marginal land, even though it's privately held, functions the same way as do natural areas that are held in common by the public, by the government. And in fact, the services provided by these areas are often more critical than large expanses of area set aside for preservation. And these aren't merely theoretical benefits. They're real. And they were not fully appreciated until these margins started to disappear and these problems started to arise. So even government agencies now, which are usually the last to come around, recognize that these natural areas are critical to maintaining the health of the land. The Department of Agriculture has what it calls the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, which subsidizes the reversion of farmland back to wetland and grassland. The Fish and Wildlife Service has a Partners for Fish and Wildlife program that encourages farmers to recreate natural habitat. The State Department of Ecology offers seminars and even private instruction to farmers on how to restore these riparian zones, these streamside habitats that are so important to the health of streams and fish. And there are nonprofit groups also that are devoted solely to this effort. There's a group in Portland called Stewardship Partners that runs a program that many of you are probably familiar with. It's the Salmon Safe program. Well, what they do is they provide marketing resources to farmers who agree to restore and rehabilitate these streamside habitats, because that's good for fish. It provides cover, it prevents erosion into streams, and allows fish to live their entire life cycles. So this idea began to catch on through the 1980s and 1990s. The idea that restoring these farm margins to a more natural state would serve both the farmer and the commons. Then in the fall of 2006, something happened that threatens to change that, and that is there was an E. coli outbreak that killed 3 people and sickened hundreds of others. Now, the bacteria was traced eventually back to spinach grown in California, but the actual source of that contamination was never determined, whether it was a result of poor farming practices or whether it was contamination that occurred in the processing, the handling, the bagging of the spinach. Nevertheless, within 3 months of that outbreak, the nation's largest agricultural trade association, the Western Growers Association, published new guidelines to farmers on farming practices. And these guidelines were called the metrics. The metrics are premised on the assumption that any contact between farmland and the natural environment poses a food safety threat. So these new guidelines require farmers to isolate their fields from natural ecosystems and the natural environment. So what does that mean? It means farmers in the Central Valley of California, where these leafy greens are primarily grown, have to drain wetlands, fill ponds, cut down trees, remove vegetation from these streamside habitats, remove all non-crop vegetation from within hundreds of yards of their fields, forming what are called bare earth buffers, sometimes called ecological sacrifice zones. To make matters worse, produce wholesalers, these are the people that go in, buy the produce from the farmers and bring them to retailers so that we can buy it, formulated their own super metrics, which call for even wider bare earth buffers, even higher fences, poison bait stations, and the result has been catastrophic. Along the Salinas River in California, trees that have stood for half a century or more have been chopped down for no other reason that was potential wildlife habitat coming within 200 or 300 yards of a farm. Probably the most unfortunate thing about the metrics and the supermetrics is that they don't have any basis in science. It is well established that animals associated with human activity, cattle, pigs, even seagulls, carry strains of E. coli that are virulent. It has not been established that pastoral wildlife species, that is species not associated with human activity, pose a similar threat. In addition, it is well established in the scientific community that wetlands and grasslands, riparian areas, neutralize these pathogens. We talked a little earlier about environmental services. Well, one of the services that's provided by these buffer zones around farm fields is the detoxification of chemicals and also pathogens. Now, the farmers whose farms are subject to the metrics don't like them very much. It makes their land quite ugly. But in truth, these metrics actually have very little impact on the farms themselves. What they do have are significant detrimental impacts on public resources. And so our only protection from these impacts, because we've privatized so much of this resource, are these government-sponsored programs to incentivize farmers to reinstall this natural habitat. Well, that, of course, is contrary to the metrics, these new guidelines put out by the industry. And maybe more importantly, it's contrary to the incentives that are offered by these same government agencies to maximize productivity. And of course, those incentives are far more lucrative. And so given the choice, which direction do you think farmers are going to go? So what we have now is questionable policies that have been put in place to ensure the safety of our food that aren't scientifically based. And I think the lesson to be learned here is that once a resource like real property is privatized, other resources associated with that land, whether on that land or affected by that land, are lost, sometimes permanently. And that, in fact, is the lesson of the Dust Bowl. In 1937, after this 8-year cycle of drought, the government began a program called Operation Dust Bowl. It brought together soil scientists and ecologists, something it had never done in formulating this plan to settle the West. It established soil conservation districts. It purchased 107,000 acres of land in a corner of Kansas. This is land that had been given away for free. The primary asset on that land, soil, had been squandered, and now the government was buying it back. And from that 107-acre parcel, the government sought to rebuild the Great Plains. Now, we're talking about millions, hundreds of millions of acres that were lost as a result of this environmental catastrophe. But what the government did on this 100,000-acre parcel is put down fast-growing weeds, first of all, to hold down the soil. It planted short grass prairie species, blue gramma, buffalo grass, and blue stem. These are species that are naturally found in this ecosystem, or were naturally found in this ecosystem. And so from this monumental failure came a little bit of wisdom. Unfortunately, though, that wisdom couldn't be fully exercised. As I said, there are hundreds of millions of acres that were lost during this eight-year period. The original plan that the government had was to buy back 75 million acres. In the end, though, it was only able to purchase 11 million acres. So parts of what used to be the Southern Great Plains look essentially the way they did at the height of the Dust Bowl in 1936. And whether that land is held in private hands or public hands, it's probably never going to recover, certainly not for centuries. So what wisdom can we glean from this unfortunate history? Well, I think there are a couple of lessons to learn. First, when we transfer a resource out of public ownership into private ownership, we need to understand what other resources we're giving up. Title to land, for instance, carries with it the exclusive right to squander other resources on that land or associated with that land, soil, for example. Second, I think we need to be aware of how the use of that privately owned resource will impact or can potentially impact the portion of that resource that remains publicly owned. And it could be that the real property resource is unique in this characteristic. I don't know, but I doubt it. I suspect that there are other resources which, if transferred into private ownership, could have significant detrimental impacts on the part of the resource that remains in the commons. That's the extent of my presentation today. I'm happy to answer any questions. I think I've got us back on track for almost on time.
What's the authority of the Western Farmers Association to impose their metrics on a large number of individual farmers who own their farms privately? In other words, what's the basis of their regulatory authority, and is that open to legal challenge? Has it been challenged in the courts?
Sure. That's a good question. These are not regulations. It's the Western Growers Association, and they have no authority except that they run the industry. 99% of leafy greens are grown in the Central Valley of California. All of the wholesalers that operate in that region, that buy from these farmers, are members of the Western Growers Association. So when the Western Growers Association says, wholesalers, you can only buy from farms that exercise or put into place these measures, farmers really have no choice. And in fact, there was a poll done not so long ago that showed in excess of 95% of farmers had taken these steps. They really have no choice. Yes?
Yes, I'm wondering if you've taken a look at, there's a bill in the Senate, I guess it's in the U.S. Congress, H.R. 875, which is the Food Modernization Safety Act. And there's a lot of controversy about whether it's going to affect small farmers, organic farmers, and farmers markets. And I'm wondering if you've looked at it and if you have an opinion about it.
Right. I have looked at it, not carefully. As I understand that, it's a bill. It's actually been supported by the Consumers Union. It is mostly aimed at adulterated food. It's a food safety measure. It does have provisions in it that, in my opinion, are certainly favorable for agribusiness, large corporations. Will it affect small farmers, organic farmers? I actually don't believe so. The reason that it's a federal bill, and the only authority the federal government has over this is produce that's put in interstate commerce. And so backyard farmers, I don't think, will be affected by that law. Yes.
So you mentioned that 99% of at least California farmers are members of the Western Growers Association. What about that other 1%? Do you think it's possible both there and elsewhere that public outcry or boycotts or some other legal method could turn the direction of that?
I hope so. The stats are actually that it's 99% or in excess of 95% of farmers have complied with the metrics. I think 100% of the wholesalers of these green leafy vegetables are members of the Western Growers Association. And those are the ones that purchase from these individual farmers. Is there a hope that this tide can be turned again and in favor of the progress that was made in the 1980s and 1990s towards restoring natural habitat to farms? I think so. I think there just needs to be a recognition that these measures are really a public relations move more than anything. It's an interesting story about why wetlands. It's well understood that wetlands provide these detoxification benefits. One of the reasons they were included in the metrics is in one bag of spinach they found a part of a frog foot. And of course that's no good for the industry for people to be fine. It's not dangerous necessarily. It doesn't pose a food safety threat. It's just, for some people, disgusting. So there's a real feeling that this is a way of communicating to the public that these are measures put in place to protect their health, when I think it's pretty clearly understood that they don't provide that measure of safety.
I was just wondering if you could make some comment or add any perspective related to the comments in genetically modified farming.
Well, I think that's a topic that's actually coming up later, I think, or maybe I'm wrong about that, but that is an entirely different area, of course. Ownership of genes, of the human genome, and of these genetically modified crops. A big issue, very controversial issue, and one that we at PCC have taken a very strong stance against. Thank you very much.
Professor Stephen Tan on the question of rights and wrongs of the American farm, given March 13th at the Law of the Commons Conference at Seattle University. Sponsored by the National Lawyers Guild. Many thanks to Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio, who recorded that talk and will interview our next guests. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
We're very lucky to have with us Carol Thompson and Bill All. Carol Thompson is a professor of political economy at Northern Arizona University. She has worked on issues of food sovereignty in Southern Africa for 3 decades. She is on the executive committee of the Association of Concerned Africa Scholars, which raises African development concerns within the U.S. government. She has just returned from another 5 months in Southern Africa, writing policy analysis for farmers' organizations on issues such as resisting the Green Revolution for Africa, agrofuels, biopiracy, and pollution by genetically modified organisms. And her most recent book is Biopiracy of Biodiversity, Global Exchange as Enclosure, co-authored with Andrew Mashita. Bill All, who has been on the show numerous times, is a local activist with Tools for Change and with the Community Alliance for Global Justice. And both Carol and Bill will be speaking today at a teach-in sponsored by the Community Alliance for Global Justice titled Confronting the Food Crisis, Cultivating Just Alternatives to the Corporate Food System. Bill and Carol, thank you both very much for spending time with us this morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Let's start out with you, Bill. Could you briefly tell us about the Community Alliance for Global Justice and then tell us about the teach-in that's happening today?
Sure. Briefly, the Community Alliance for Global Justice was started in the aftermath of the festivities in Seattle in 1999 against the WTO. And activists from around the community wanted to create an organization that would look at the multiple issues that are confronting us, both locally and globally, and to link the issues around trade and justice in the international arena with what was happening in Seattle. And we started off doing work around fair trade and against the free trade agreements over the years. And many of us participated in protests and letter writing and so on about that. And a few years ago, we decided that it was really about strengthening local economies everywhere. That was key. So linking agriculture and food justice here with what was happening on other places in Latin America and Africa. And so we still continue our work around fair trade and against free trade, but we've really deepened and enriched our approach by working with farmers and working with food justice activists in the city. And we've done several dinners highlighting strengthening local economies everywhere.
Very good. And you are sponsoring a teach-in that's happening all day today at Seattle Central Community College.
Yeah, the food crisis has really become on the top of all of our minds over the past 6 to 8 months. The media finally started to pay attention to what was going on in the world around us, and it started coming home in lots of ways in the prices that we're paying in the grocery stores and so on. And we realized that it was time for us to bring, again, that mix of people, farmers, scholars, activists together to look at all the dimensions of the food crisis. And so the teach-in is going on at Seattle Community College, Central Community College, and it's got workshops ranging from how to build your own worm bin and how to get food from lots of alternative sources to confronting the Alliance for the Green Revolution in Africa, which we'll talk about a little bit later today. This morning, and also looking at food security and food justice issues right here in Seattle. So it's really exciting, and we had a great kickoff last night with Carol, Lucy Giroux, Carlos Marentes, and Sue McCann from Mara Farms with a great panel and community discussion.
All right. Carol, you have just recently returned from the region of Southern Africa, and we're hearing right now in the news that Zimbabwe is making the news that there is a cholera outbreak or epidemic there. Can you talk about Zimbabwe and what isn't being covered in the news?
Yes, I was over 4 months in Zimbabwe until August, and I've lived approximately a total of 10 years in Zimbabwe over the last 25 years. And what is happening in Zimbabwe in terms of the news is a cholera epidemic. They're estimating over 600 people have died, which means 6 to 10,000 people have cholera. And as the news is also reporting, the economy is in a total meltdown. The Zimbabwe dollar continues to fall. They estimate over 200% inflation. And don't ask any economists what that means, because we don't know what that means. What it basically means is the people are not in the formal economy. They're sourcing food through networks, through social relationships, and growing their own food. But this is, and it is because of the tyranny of the current government. I was there during the second elections when the opposition candidate removed himself because of the corruption and the violence. And then Robert Mugabe got himself reelected as the single candidate. But no one has recognized the government or the elections. So you know all that basically from the news, but that's only half the story, because this has been going on now for about 8 years, since 2000. And why has the formal economy toppled, and how can a government possibly stay in power with that happening? So the other half of the news is that the government does stay in power through the exporting illegally of gold, diamonds, platinum, and chrome. And you've heard this before on the African continent, the incredible resources that are at the basis of conflict and mayhem and murder. What we don't talk about enough yet in the United States is who's buying the chrome, the platinum, the gold, and the diamonds. And that is the same answer that we've had for a couple of hundred years. It's the European countries and the United States. And in this particular equation, it's also South African capital. So while the United States very correctly admonishes the Zimbabwe government for the human rights abuses, it does not talk about the U.S. corporations that are profiting from the repression. One of the major U.S. corporations are buying the chrome. The gold and the diamonds go via South Africa, De Beers, South African gold fields, and the platinum is mainly through British capital and British global corporations. So basically, there will be a stalemate in Zimbabwe until the theft of the minerals becomes less profitable and the business interests want to have the economy go back into gear in terms of retail sales, tourist industry, housing. But right now, repression is very profitable.
And how do we as world citizens respond to that?
One of the issues that we need to talk about, and it has happened in other organizing, is if we just admonish the civil rights abuses, it's not sufficient. We have to do the analysis of what American corporations are profiting from repression, from torture. And that hasn't happened for Zimbabwe. And so as Americans, we need to expose those corporations and expose those economic links. And that is one of the things that the Association of Concerned Africa Scholars is beginning to organize. It's kind of amazing that you've had a lot of outcry in favor of the Zimbabwe people and their suffering, but no mention of the U.S. link to that suffering.
So one can find the direct links by following the money in this situation?
Yes. What I'm basically saying is we don't yet have the direct information, and the reason for that, of course, is this is all underground exchange, underground export. The diamonds are alluvial diamonds in the eastern part of Zimbabwe, and you basically can almost scrape them off the riverbank. So the government is involved in the corruption, it's very, very difficult to get accurate data. But there are places now that are beginning to talk about it, and we need to start organizing about it, and that hasn't begun.
All right. Along the same lines, here in Seattle, we have a local organization, philanthropic organization, that gets a lot of media play, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And I didn't know this prior, but from going to the Community Alliance for Global Justice website, I found out that they are involved in a program called AGRA. And I'm wondering if you can tell us about that and tell us your thoughts on whether that's a good program or not.
Yes. Let's start with the food crisis in Africa, because generally when we think about the continent of Africa, not just about the basket case of Zimbabwe, that Africa is always in food crisis someplace, and that the continent is food deficit. The estimates are about 50 million Africans chronically malnourished, and that would be everywhere from Ethiopia, Eritrea, down through southern Africa. So one of the issues constantly for the development of Africa are the food sovereignty and food security. Because of this chronic condition, which relates not to production of food but to the distribution of food, the Gates Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation joined together in 2006 to create the Alliance for a Green Revolution for Africa called AGRA. In 2007, they hired Kofi Annan, the ex-UN Secretary General, to be the executive director. So they got a very high-profile person to lead their AGRA association.